Serafin hier. Ihr hört den Podcast von netzpolitik.org. Das Europäische Parlament befürchtet, dass der Einsatz künstlicher Intelligenz die Freiheitsrechte der BürgerInnen gefährdet. Anfang des Monats hat das Europäische Parlament eine Resolution mit Details zur Regulierung von KI verabschiedet und dabei erstaunlich klare Worte gefunden. Es geht um den sogenannten AI Act. Gesichtserkennung soll darin zum Beispiel verboten werden, Predictive Policing, also Polizeiarbeit auf der Grundlage von künstlicher Intelligenz, die bekommt ebenfalls eine Absage, und zum Beispiel Algorithmen sollen transparent gemacht werden. Spannende Sachen also. Die Abstimmung im Europaparlament hat medial nicht besonders viel Aufmerksamkeit bekommen. Aber wenn die Vorschläge übernommen werden, dann könnten wir es mit der weltweit ersten Regulierung von künstlicher Intelligenz in dieser Größe zu tun haben. Heute im Netzpolitik-Podcast: Alexander Fanter und Chris Köfer haben mit Sarah Chander und Ella Jakubowska gesprochen. Die beiden arbeiten für die Organisation European Digital Rights, kurz EDRI. Die Expertinnen für künstliche Intelligenz und biometrische Überwachung haben uns erzählt, warum die Abstimmung so wichtig war und was genau drin steckt. Leider sprechen die beiden kein Deutsch, deshalb ist der Großteil unseres Podcasts heute auf Englisch. Ihr findet mehr deutschsprachige Infos zum Thema auf netzpolitik.org.
I'm good to go.
I can start recording on my side now.
Bei mir ist jetzt Alex, um ein bisschen über die Abstimmung zu sprechen, während Chris im Urlaub ist. Hallo Alex.
Hallo.
Worum geht's denn jetzt bei dieser Abstimmung?
Das Europäische Parlament setzt sich ja seit Jahren auseinander mit Biometrie und der heiklen Frage, wie kann Europa ethisch mit dieser Technologie umgehen, zumal wenn es in einen heiklen, sensiblen Bereich wie Strafverfolgung hineingeht. Und was das Europäische Parlament vor kurzem gemacht hat, ist, es hat eine Abstimmung über einen Bericht gemacht, der zwar in sich noch keine rechtliche Wirkung hat, aber der als prägend für spätere Entscheidungen gilt. Und in diesem Bericht hat das Europäische Parlament gesagt, dass es klare Schranken geben muss für den Einsatz von biometrischer Überwachung in Echtzeit im öffentlichen Raum.
Heißt das, man kann jetzt daran ablesen, sozusagen, wie, in welche Richtung die nächsten Wahlen oder Gesetze des Europaparlaments in Richtung künstliche Intelligenz gehen?
In wenigen Monaten steht eine weitere Entscheidung an im Europäischen Parlament, und zwar über die parlamentseigene Position zur KI-Verordnung, also der Verordnung über den Einsatz von künstlicher Intelligenz, und die wird dann sehr wohl rechtlich bindend sein, beziehungsweise die Verhandlungsposition des Parlaments festlegen für Gespräche über einen endgültigen Text, der dann bindend ist. Und das Parlament hat mit dieser Abstimmung so eine Art Vorentscheidung getroffen, die schon Blöcke einschlägt für die endgültige Festlegung. Ja, Sarah von EDRI hat das als eine Art Lackmustest bezeichnet, also eine Probe, eine Nagelprobe, die dann prägend wirkt für die endgültige Abstimmung.
We call this a litmus test for the general sense of the European Parliament on some of the main issues related to data protection, privacy, anti-discrimination, freedom of expression, all of these issues vis-a-vis AI. And although there have been a number of sort of parliament reports on this, previously they were very general, And now this report specifically relates to the positions Parliament on law enforcement uses of artificial intelligence. The reason I think the law enforcement focus of this report is a good litmus test for our rights and freedoms is because we're then basically deciding, okay, what is the Parliament's view of how far invasive technology should be able to be used by the state, particularly in cases where people, individuals, groups, communities don't have very much control over it. We've seen other European Parliament policymakers discussing AI in consumer contexts, AI in various different contexts where actually you might have some say, basically, over, or at least some knowledge about whether AI systems are being used on you. For many of the cases that we've been discussing in this Parliament report, like predictive policing, like facial recognition in the public space, individuals rarely know that such technologies are being used on them when they're going about their everyday lives.
Warum war denn diese Abstimmung so was Besonderes? War irgendwas anderes als bei bisherigen Debatten um KI im Europaparlament?
Das EU-Parlament hat immer wieder gerungen mit seiner Position und erst vor einigen Monaten gab es eine Abstimmung, wo das Parlament gesagt hat, es soll ein Moratorium geben auf Gesichtserkennung im öffentlichen Raum, aber sich eben nicht recht durchringen konnte zu einem dieser Sache komplett die Absage zu erteilen. Was wir jetzt sehen, ist, dass das Parlament immer stärker in die Richtung geht, aus ethischen Gründen Gesichtserkennung eine völlige Absage zu erteilen. Und das ist quasi die Debatte, die wir dann auch haben werden mit der eigentlichen Verordnung, wo das Parlament in einigen Monaten seine Position festlegen wird. Ein weiteres brandheißes Beispiel, wo immer wieder scharf diskutiert wird, auch im Parlament, ist Predictive Policing, also der Einsatz von KI, um mögliche Verbrechen in einem bestimmten Ort zu einer bestimmten Zeit vorherzusagen. Auch das ist sehr umstritten, denn KritikerInnen fürchten, dass das vorverurteilend wirkt für die Gegenden, in denen, wo dann die KI quasi Verbrechen vorhersagt. Das sind übermäßig oft arme, sozioökonomisch schwache Gegenden, wo Angehörige ethnischer Minderheiten leben. Und das ist auch etwas, was Sarah in dem Interview sehr klar herausstellt. Diese Technologien haben so großes Potenzial, diskriminierend zu wirken, dass man sie besser nicht einsetzen sollte in Europa.
There have been many studies about predictive policing and we've seen that actually they disproportionately often target for over-policing communities of poor working class communities, racialized communities, places where people with migrant backgrounds live. And so it's a fundamentally question about actually should the police be able to make decisions on the basis of things that haven't happened yet, pre-crime behavior. The Parliament, and we thought this was very progressive, in this recent report, said that they oppose the use of AI by law enforcement authorities to make behavioral predictions on people on the basis of a bunch of criteria, so including historical data and information about our past behavior, but also location and many other things like that. So this was a really strong stance, in essence, against predictive policing, which is one of the main reasons we thought this was a very progressive step and a good sign for the future legislative process.
There's been a lot of discussion going on about facial recognition used by the police, but I mean, actually, we're not just talking about facial recognition, right? Because there's other ways to use biometric surveillance. So what is the stance that the Parliament is taking on this issue?
As EDRI and the Reclaim Your Face campaign, we've actually been campaigning for a long time against any use of facial recognition or other systems that recognize the way that people walk, other things about their behaviors and bodies, when it's used in ways that lead to mass surveillance. So that could be the use of facial recognition drones on people protesting or other kind of biometric, quote unquote, smart systems in parks or shopping centers or schools. And so what we've seen in this new report from the Parliament is really it's democracy in action, because we've had 62,000 people from across the EU, 65 civil society organizations from across a really broad range of justice and human rights issues, all calling for a ban on biometric mass surveillance. And that's exactly what we've seen now being passed in this parliamentary report. They've explicitly called to ban biometric mass surveillance in law enforcement contexts. The parliament really clearly said that they are refusing to water down this protection of fundamental rights against biometric mass surveillance, because there were attempts from certain minorities in the parliament to use fear or to use kind of a lot of the mythology around amazing shiny new technologies to try and say that there shouldn't be limitations on police uses of facial recognition and other biometric mass surveillance systems. And the parliament threw that out. They said, no, we are very clearly going to put people and people's rights first. Secondly, they've also reverse the burden of proof back to where it should be. So we've heard a lot of calls from certain parts of the parliament, from industry, saying, let's just try this stuff out. Let's not regulate it. Let's let it run its course as if it's somehow something natural, and then work out what to do. And this report, again, is saying, no, absolutely not. That's not how human rights work. Actually, you need to prove that this thing is not going to harm people, not going to unduly restrict their rights to privacy, free expression, non-discrimination. And if you can't prove that, then you need to ban it. And that's exactly what the EU's fundamental rights framework says we need to do.
Also, was wäre denn die grundsätzliche Kritik an künstlicher Intelligenz, an der Anwendung von künstlicher Intelligenz im Bereich der Strafverfolgung?
Ich glaube, diese Technologie stellt uns vor eine grundsätzliche ethische Herausforderung. Wir haben technologische Möglichkeiten, die vor 10, 15 Jahren einfach nicht existiert haben. Und wir sehen jetzt schon immer wieder Beispiele, wo versucht wird, das einzusetzen. Aber das Problem ist einerseits die hohe Fehleranfälligkeit dieser Technologie, wo dann auf einmal für Menschen, also über Menschen Entscheidungen getroffen werden, die krasse Konsequenzen haben. Also wenn mich eine Maschine identifiziert, fälschlicherweise, hat das krasse und negative Konsequenzen für mich. Aber auf der anderen Seite geht es auch um die grundsätzlichere Frage, möchte man überhaupt automatisiert und quasi eine gigantische Maschine aufbauen, die dann permanent in unser Leben eingreift in dieser Art. Und ich glaube, das ist etwas Wichtiges, das auch in dem Interview mit Sarah und Ella gesagt wird, nämlich, dass Menschen eben keine Testmeerschweinchen sein sollen für Technologien im Strafvollzug, sondern dass es immer noch eine menschliche Kontrolle und eine menschliche Balance geben muss in prägenden Entscheidungen für Menschen.
Often it's like reading a dystopian sci-fi novel when you look at the projects that are getting millions and millions of euros of public money that are to do with biometrics. It's really horrifying stuff. It's attempts to create lie detectors despite the fact that there's no scientific basis for that. It's about attempts to criminalize people on the move, attempts to see if people are suspicious. And so the whole ideology underneath that research and innovation can be really, really sinister. So the parliament, again, is saying you shouldn't be researching and innovating with people's rights and freedoms. Privacy, equality are not something to put into a lab and test with. People are not guinea pigs. And law enforcement should not have less scrutiny and be able to do whatever they like without checks and balances. They should have more scrutiny. And we've seen around the world how, when they're unchecked, the use of these technologies by police can be some of the most profoundly harmful uses of technology in society.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting that you mentioned the lie detector research. I think that is technology that has been researched to border control, like who's entering the European Union, right?
Yes, that's right. There's been a really notorious project called Eye Border Control. And everything from the, you know, the reason why they're trying to do it, which is to detect if people on the move are supposedly lying, if they're untrustworthy, is really, you know, it's not something that we should be outsourcing to technology. It's already, there are much wider structural problems in the immigration and border space in that it's a very discretionary process. It's very hard already to know if people are being treated fairly. And for those of us in civil society, for example, to contest unfair decisions. So when you add on top of that already very murky and opaque context where people are put in a very vulnerable position and very disempowered compared to the authorities that they're facing, you add technology on top of it that doesn't have a scientific basis, that's been shown to be very prejudiced, has been shown to really interpret that racialized people, for example, are angrier than white people, which is a piece of research that we saw in the US with a lot of the most common algorithms. We're starting from a place of really, really unjust assumptions. And by using that technology, we're just amplifying that. And as if all that's not bad enough, the whole eye border control experiment has also been done in a completely untransparent way, to the point where an MEP, Patrick Bryant, has actually taken the commission to court for failing to disclose almost any information about what they're trying to do here with public money.
Yeah, I think it's a great example because it shows what or how this technology is being deployed or could be deployed in the future in the European Union if we leave it entirely unregulated. Because a lot of the examples that we hear that are really dystopian are from a US context, but I think it's a great example to show now what is already happening in the context of the European Union as well.
Totally. And I do want to make the point that we often think, oh, China, the US, that's where these really scary things are happening. But actually, there's a lot of it going on in the EU as well. We've released a lot of reports looking at the evidence. And in the Netherlands, for example, they're already using these automated AI-based systems to predict if people are being aggressive and using that to deploy police vehicles, who are primed, ready to intervene in what they think is a violent conflict, which, for the people that are being marked out as aggressive could, really, you could have profound impacts on them. And if you're somebody, often a racialized or minoritized person that already faces disproportionately high amounts of police intervention, you could actually really be at harm with this. And these trends are also replicated in other uses of biometric mass surveillance. We're seeing in Germany, for example, people going in and out of gay bars being surveilled and having their faces used to identify and track them.
Wenn wir jetzt diese Abstimmung lesen, wer profitiert davon, glaubst du? Und wer ärgert sich jetzt und sieht sein eigenes Geschäftsmodell in Gefahr?
Also ein Ärgernis ist das sicher für diejenigen Sicherheitsbehörden, diejenigen Strafverfolgungsbehörden in Europa, die schon experimentieren mit der Technologie und hoffen, sie einsetzen zu können. Wir haben ja immer mehr Polizeibehörden, die mal zum Beispiel zu Anbietern wie dem amerikanischen Konzern Palantir gehen und sich dort Produkte holen, die es angeblich mit der Hilfe von künstlicher Intelligenz erleichtern, Daten auszuwerten. In der Praxis muss man allerdings sagen, waren viele dieser Tests auch unerfolgreich. Also ich schätze mal, das größte Ärgernis sind diese Restriktionen auf den Einsatz von biometrischer und anderer KI-Überwachungstechnologie, vor allem für Konzerne, die hier Dienstleistungen anbieten. Denn die Polizeien entwickeln das ja vielfach eigentlich nicht selbst. Profitieren von diesen Einschränkungen werden sicherlich diejenigen marginalisierten Gruppen in unserer Gesellschaft, die bereits jetzt übermäßig im Visier von polizeilichen Überwachungsmaßnahmen stehen, also ärmere Bevölkerungsgruppen, ethnische Minderheiten, die bereits jetzt schon vielfach auch ungerechtfertigt unter Verdacht gestellt werden. Und die haben jetzt größeren Schutz davor, dass quasi in einer grundrechtswidrigen oder in einer für die Grundrechte problematischen Art und Weise ermittelt wird.
All of these systems fundamentally have a first point of contact, which are the marginalized, the criminalized in our society. So one particular case study that we've been keeping an eye on for a time are the number of risk assessment tools that are used in the Netherlands in terms of social services, which is very much overlapped with policing. So systems which have been designed to test whether young people are potentially either posing a risk of being criminals in the future, posing a risk of being social nuisances, or being posing a risk of having child protection issues. All of these have basically involved a massive growing infrastructure of collecting data about particular young people. And when we say particular young people, we mean kids from working class backgrounds, kids from families with a migrant background, kids that are racialized. So the ProKid system in the Netherlands basically used a really wide range of data, including whether the kids had high school absences, whether the kids were from families with single mothers, and also whether the kids were in areas that were known to be previously high crime. And when we say known to be high crimes, it means do they have an existing police presence and therefore a high number of arrests? And also, which crimes are we talking about? So often, these systems focus on crimes that we associate with poor people, making it a criminal matter to assess people's social situation, as if this is a good indicator of whether these children were future criminals, and therefore the police need to keep their eye on them. Children as young as 14 and sometimes even younger been basically profiled many times in the week, every day. The psychological effects of that being felt to be a criminal, even if there's nothing that these kids have ever done. And really instilling the notion that from a very young age, certain populations simply need to be controlled by the police. Essentially, what we're doing when we think about these systems is also not just expanding the reach of the criminal justice system, but we're also increasingly involving private companies into functions that were previously public functions. So many of these systems have been designed by a private company. So Predpol, for instance, is one of the most famous companies associated with predictive policing systems. Basically, from the point of design, even up to the point of delivery, the private company makes huge decisions about how this system works, what type of data it uses, how the algorithm functions in order to generate these risk scores. In essence, then, what we have is a broader problem beyond discrimination, a broader problem of who controls the decisions that are made in the public space, in the public function. The more and more we see AI used in the criminal law space, the more and more we see AI used in the social services space and in migration control spaces, we see the co-option of public functions into the realm of the private sphere. And that should be a much broader concern for us in terms of democracy and accountability of our public actors. If the decisions that are being made in the public sphere about social welfare, policing, migration control, are in essence very determined by private technologies, how can we as individuals challenge them in democratic means? This is another question beyond these individual questions of our rights that we need to challenge, because we cannot necessarily easily challenge them in a legal form. They're fundamentally economic and political questions.
Im April gab es schon einen Vorschlag von der EU-Kommission zu dem Thema. Was wurde denn dort gesagt und was ist jetzt anders? Was hat sich jetzt weiterentwickelt?
Also im April hat die EU-Kommission eine Verordnung vorgeschlagen, die eben den ethischen Umgang mit künstlicher Intelligenz regeln soll. Dieser Vorschlag liegt jetzt im EU-Parlament und das Parlament sucht eben eine eigene Position dazu. Der Bericht, der abgestimmt wurde, greift dem vor und er quasi legt auf eine nicht bindende Art und Weise schon mal eine Position dar des Parlaments, und diese Position fließt dann eben ein in die in die Verhandlungsposition, mit der das Parlament dann weitergeht. Und was als nächstes passieren wird, ist, das EU-Parlament legt eine eigene Position fest und geht dann in Verhandlungen mit den EU-Staaten, also mit dem Rat und auch mit der Kommission. Und in diesen Verhandlungen wird dann ein endgültiger Gesetzestext geschrieben, der dann auch tatsächlich rechtlich bindend ist für eine Verordnung. Das ist die typische Wurstfabrik, in der europäische Gesetze entstehen. Was das Interessante daran ist, der Vorschlag der Kommission, und an dem wird sich grundsätzlich wahrscheinlich nichts ändern, der sieht eben vor, dass man gewisse Technologien verbietet und gewisse andere Technologien in verschiedene Risikostufen einordnet. Verbieten möchte die Kommission eigentlich nur quasi biometrische Massenüberwachung, also quasi Überwachung, die überall stattfindet, und Social Scoring, wie es in China bereits passieren soll. Hingegen möchte die Kommission an einigen Orten zielgerichtete biometrische Echtzeitüberwachung, etwa Gesichtserkennung, nicht ganz verbieten, sondern nur als Hochrisiko einstufen. Und an diesen Definitionen, was ein hohes Risiko ist, was ganz verboten werden muss, da wird sicher intensiv gefeilt und gestritten werden.
Okay, und jetzt ist der neue Entwurf vom EU-Parlament ist jetzt noch um einiges klarer und strenger.
Wir gehen davon aus, dass das Parlament das, was es in seinen nicht bindenden Berichten bisher schon reingeschrieben hat und eben wo es sich etwa für ganz harte Verbote und Einschränkungen auf Gesichtserkennung im öffentlichen Raum in Echtzeit ausspricht, dass es das auch versuchen wird, in das Gesetz hineinzuschreiben. Was wir auf jeden Fall auch erwarten, ist, dass die EU-Staaten eine Gegenposition einnehmen und hier eher Möglichkeiten, Räume schaffen wollen, für die Behörden Überwachungsmaßnahmen zu setzen. Und diesen Clash, der wird hinter verschlossenen Türen stattfinden. Aber die Vorentscheidungen, die Weichen sind jetzt eigentlich gestellt worden, beziehungsweise werden noch gestellt im Parlament.
Can you tell us a little bit about what influenced the Commission in actually writing the draft? Do you think that industry, that certain industry groups, for instance, had a large influence on the way that the draft has been made?
At the Commission stage, the AI Act followed the regular process, right? So there was a public consultation on the European Commission's before it released the Act. So you had citizens, you had academics, you had civil society, and you had industry inputting into that. I think always generally there's a question about the role, particularly of big tech lobbying on digital legislation at the EU level. And if you look at the report by the Corporate Europe Observatory, you really see very astounding figures about just how much big tech spends on lobbying the European Union institutions. I don't think the AI Act is an exception to that, particularly because you'll see from civil society's level in the Corporate Europe Observatory's mapping, you'll see the number of meetings that big tech have access, even at the European Commission level, to take an influence, to influence this type of legislation. The same with the Digital Services Act and the Digital Markets Act. So already, like, we're at a power imbalance because civil society just cannot spend the same amount of money that big tech can, and therefore has more resources, but I would say also more access to the policymaking institutions. And that really, at least for me, it really plays out in the language that is used, the ideology that is put forward around the Act. So at the same time, we are supposed to accept that this Act has fundamental rights at the centre and that is designed to promote a human-centric approach to AI regulation. but also it's very heavily dominated by industry language. So very huge claims consistently made about the need not to stunt innovation, the need to promote the uptake of AI. All of this coming from this very strong ideology from industry that we cannot be too strong on limiting how technology is used, because this will put Europe at a disadvantage, particularly using arguments that the US and Europe need to unite, otherwise they will have already lost the battle with China, which means then you're sort of left with this duality. The European Union institutions are asking us to accept that we can have both. We cannot in any way limit innovation, but we also put forward fundamental rights. We would like, I think, to find this middle ground, but I think on some of the issues that we've put as red lines, facial recognition in the public space, predictive policing systems, AI systems that are designed to detect our emotions despite the false science that they're based on, these are red lines that you cannot innovate out of, because simply they fundamentally compromise the basic principles of freedom, of anti-discrimination, etc. So I think here that the industry influence is massive on it, and it's also pushed the discourse to be somewhat contradictory, particularly on the fundamental rights side.
I was wondering how member states actually influence and shape that discourse, because a lot of the kind of representatives of European industry also now pushing into the AI sphere and feel that they need to kind of follow the trail that American companies have broken. So do you feel that there's particular member states are pushing this line of having more innovation at the expense of a human rights focus?
We've seen both from some individual commissioners, but also from a number of member state governments, this desire to be the first to have positive AI strategies, really without thinking about what it means for society, but also what it means for the environment, for example. If we see churning out more and more AI as the end goal in itself. On a personal level, I used to work in the tech sector, and I know that data scientists, developers, they often try things out because they are cool, because it's amazing to see what you are able to do, rather than because you need it or because it's the right thing to do. And so I've seen from the other side, the need to make sure that when things are going to market, when things are being made available in the EU, that they are the right things and not just the things that one person with no understanding of human rights and anti-discrimination thought was cool. Because when we let that happen, we've seen studies come out around the world about AI facial recognition systems that claim to be able to predict somebody's political orientation and even their sexual orientation based on their face structure and their expressions. And that's something that goes all the way back to Victorian era, discredited race science and phrenology, with this new veneer of scientific credibility behind this AI impulse. So we really do know the cliche. I think it's Batman, maybe, the just because you can doesn't mean you should. And I think it's really, really important that we remember that. And, I do want to give credit where credit is due to the European Commission, because what they've tried to do here is incredibly difficult. This is the first comprehensive AI legislative proposal in the world. And what they've done is approached it in the way that you would approach consumer product safety. And we have found that there are some key ways then in the Act itself that it's not really worked. It's not been able to fit to the context of AI and the fact that using AI can have a really transformative impact on our societies, and sometimes in ways that are really negative for us as people. So, that this Act has clearly not been formulated as a piece of fundamental rights legislation. And that's really where it falls down. And on the facial recognition and biometrics point that we've talked about quite a lot, although there's some cautiously positive bits on biometrics, there are elements where we could even see it as deregulation, that this act is undermining important principles that we already have in fundamental rights law in the EU. And so really, at that kind of highest level of this framework that we're looking at for AI, there are some real significant problems that it just isn't prioritizing people.
Was wir jetzt hier gehört haben, weist auf die Schwierigkeiten, auf die Problematik hin, auf die laufenden Diskussionen. Ich glaube, was wichtig ist zu betonen, dass Europa hier einen Rahmen schaffen kann, der auch international beachtet wird. Das war schon in der Vergangenheit so, wo Europa grundrechtsrelevante Digitalgesetzgebung gemacht hat. Die Datenschutzgrundverordnung ist hier ein Beispiel, das ein Standard geworden ist, dem auch andere Wirtschaftsräume und Staaten gefolgt sind. Ich glaube, dass das auch bei Regulierung rund um künstliche Intelligenz der Fall sein kann. Also wenn Europa ein strenges und gutes Gesetz schafft, das die Grundrechte oder die Einhaltung der Grundrechte wirklich schützt, dann kann das auch weltweit etwas sein, das Beachtung und Durchsetzung findet. Also in diesem Sinne ist es besonders wichtig, dass Europa hier ein starkes Gesetz schafft.
Und wenn es zum Gesetz wird, wie lange dauert das jetzt noch?
Ich glaube, wir müssen damit rechnen, also europäische Gesetzgebungsprozesse dauern immer lange. Ich glaube, es ist realistisch zu sagen, wir könnten ein Ergebnis haben im Jahr 2022, vielleicht 2023. In Kraft treten wird wohl ein Gesetz, das Europa jetzt macht, nicht vor 2024. Also ich glaube, 2 bis 3 Jahre sind ein realistischer Zeitraum. Sarah, I was hearing you talk, I was wondering, does it sometimes frustrate you as advocates that the media is paying so little attention on these processes within the parliament, within the council? Or to paraphrase this a little bit, would you say that that journalists could do a better job at helping to accompany the process and report consistently on the actual process of lawmaking?
I can maybe give some of my own personal insights in this, because I've been in the EU policy space for about 2 years now, and it is incredibly complex. And even when you try and break it down to its simplest kind of bare bones, there's still so many different rules and exceptions, and it's a difficult thing to get your head around. But I guess we could take it up to even a step back and think about how a lot of people, I believe, in the EU don't even really know the fundamentals. They might see the EU as this homogenous block and not even have that knowledge that there are different institutions, how that, at least in theory, helps us to achieve democratic consensus. Because actually what I've found personally as I've learned more and more is that, for all its faults, the EU does do a really good job of something that is exceptionally difficult and complicated. There are now 27 countries being represented, and I think it's something like 340 million people. So how do you find rules that are fair and representative of the majority of those people? So I think both coming from within the institutions, but also absolutely journalists could help us to communicate that, and civil society as well. We try and do that, but it can be easier to appeal to those people that already get it and to do very complicated policy analyses. So we also try and as EDRI in the last few years, we've been really ramping up our campaigning capacity to be able to reach people more broadly, to show why these processes matter, convince people, hopefully, that they're interesting. So I think working together to dispel some of the presumptions that the EU is this far away bureaucratic institution that's irrelevant to most of our lives, and actually seeing that each of us have, you know, everything we do every day has a connection to what happens in the halls of Brussels. And things like the European Citizens Initiative that we've been running for most of this year is one way that we are trying to help people see how their voices can actually directly input into the legislative process, because the European Citizens Initiative is an official tool that's put at the disposal of EU citizens by the European Commission that allows us to actually make a demand for a piece of law. And, you know, that's quite a powerful and unique thing. But what we've found as we've been running our ECI is that almost nobody in all of the EU knows that they exist, let alone that we all have a right to sign them, to create our own. And we've had some coverage from the press about this ECI, but I think so far in kind of mainstream media, we are yet to properly demonstrate to people why that is exciting, why that is relevant. And so I think on all of us, yeah, we could absolutely do more to show how powerful and interesting this space actually is.
Das war der Podcast von Netzpolitik.org. Vielen Dank an Sarah Chanda und Ella Jakubowska von European Digital Rights. Das Gespräch geführt haben Alexander Fanta und Chris Köver. Die Folge wurde produziert von mir, Serafin Dinges. Unser Titellied ist von Trommerschlunk, zusätzliche Musik von mir. Mehr Infos zum heutigen Thema findet ihr natürlich auf Netzpolitik.org und in den Shownotes. Und wie immer, vielen, vielen Dank an unsere SpenderInnen. Netzpolitik wird komplett von euch getragen. Für die Freiheit und Unabhängigkeit, die uns das erlaubt, sagen wir Danke. Wenn ihr auch ein paar Euros spenden wollt, findet ihr alle Möglichkeiten dazu auf netzpolitik.org. Das war's für heute. Bis in ein paar Wochen.